Now, if you picked up one paper, you should have picked up two. So I'll go around. There are, one of them is, that's what I said I would do. So, the one without with all the blank spots, that's the one we're going to cover today. We're going to kind of rush over some of the other ones that I just kind of filled in my notes for you. So did you get two?
Oh, yeah.
I looked at the date on it and said, why do you need that?
Yeah. That's what I did.
Looked at the date.
But, pardon me?
We looked at the date and said, oh, that was last week's.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was last week's, except we only got to one chapter. One of the chapters last week, and we didn't get to the anger parts of the section. So, and I even filled in last week's notes as well. There's two pages back there. So we're going to just kind of go over quickly, because as I thought about who was attending my class, I haven't noticed any anger outbursts except for maybe Jerry a little bit on his blogs. I've read all of them, I think, so far. Well, maybe not all from the past, but all of the events since I've done it for the last month. So you should look at justaverageamerican.com. You'll hear Jerry. You will hear Jerry speak those words because of the expressions he puts in there. Just imagine him sitting there listening and saying,
I love that when you can tell who's writing it from that.
But I really like the one where you say, I was selling insurance for 7 or 8 years. If you want to have a good time, don't do that. Yeah. I can hear Jerry saying that.
Yeah. Less than 100.
So,
makes you want to kill people. I don't know. Life insurance, kill people. I don't know.
No. The only problems I have is when he starts writing about UCLA. So, anyway, we are looking at impatience, irritability, anger, and the weeds of anger. Kind of brush over this because, as I said, was saying, I don't usually have problems with. I have problems with them. And I want to skip it. That's why we're skipping it.
That's it.
Actually, I had a problem just a week and a half ago with irritability, I guess, and this ear was bothering me and so forth. And I'd been called and said there's some headphones for the computer lab up in the front office. And so when I went up to get them, there's a couple of fairly large boxes. I'm not real heavy, but there was two of them, and it would have taken a couple of trips, and I figured the custodian could take it in a cart and take them on down to the lab, and she was sitting right there, so I asked her if she could do it, and she acted real put out about doing it, and started making comments, and I said, okay, and I started to walk away, and she says, I don't know why people can't carry their own stuff. So I got a little bit irritable there. And I said, I don't know why people are just sitting around doing nothing. She was sitting down visiting her good buddy, the principal secretary. I was saying it as I was walking down the hallway away. So, I'm on my break, she yells out at me. I just real quick enough to take account leave.
It's just the regulars.
It's the regulars. But anyway, I felt bad about it right away. She's the custodian who cleans my room, so you don't just when she came down, a few minutes later, I apologized for making the comment. I was wrong. She was wrong in how she handled it too, but I was wrong for my thing. But I was irritable. Mm-hmm. And
bring your Starbucks next week.
Pardon?
Bring her Starbucks next week.
Bring her Starbucks. Bring her some Starbucks. Yeah. Well, this was a week and a half ago.
It doesn't matter. One for her and one for the secretary, so she doesn't just think it's her.
I see. Well, the way he defines it, there's no real word for irritability, and as far as saying this is a sin. But Bridges has basically defined impatience as being annoyed at the faults or failures of others, maybe whether they're intentional or not. I think he basically says unintentional, but I would say you get impatient with people who are intentionally doing something wrong as well. And then irritability basically is how frequently and how often, how easy is it for you to to lose your patience, and it's the type of person that you know you're walking on eggshells around certain people because you're afraid you're going to set them off in the wrong direction. And we probably all had people around there like that. Ann lives with a guy that she has to walk on eggshells around because of his impatience and irritability. But there's always this tension there, and you're just afraid, when's the next blow-up going to take place? And an interesting comment that Bridges makes in here is that situations or people do not cause us to be impatient. They just provide an opportunity for the flesh.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Opportunity for it to come out.
So I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. There's two words in the Bible that are talked about. Actually, in the New International Version, 1 Corinthians 13, I think it's verse 5, it says, love is not easily provoked, and I think NIV says, love is not irritable. So if you want to get to that way, you can say irritable is in the Bible, but it's not one of the words for impatience. The two words are having to do with long-suffering, which means that you are long-tempered, not short-tempered. It takes a lot to tick you off before you explode. And that's the word that's used as part of the fruit of the Spirit when we go to Galatians 5:22, as well as in Colossians 3:12 and Ephesians 4, where it's talked about. It's talking about having a long temper. And then the other word has to do with being in endurance. And it's the word I normally think of as being patient because it has to do with being under pressure. And the literal meaning of the Greek word is to abide under. And so it has the idea of something's got pressure on you and you're just able to abide and continue. And so it's the word that's used in James when we say, count it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that they work patience, and so forth. That's the passage that's it's used there. And so when we're being tested, when we're under trial, and we just have to stick it out, that's the word endurance. It's what Jesus had, 1 Peter 2:20 on your notes there. It's the word when Jesus was being reviled and so forth, and he was patient. He was abiding under those difficult circumstances. I don't think it's in your... No, it's really under anger, the next thing I was going to say, so I'll wait till I get there. And then Bridges makes some comments about being the object of someone else's impatience. If someone like I was towards this custodian, how should you react? And so he goes to 1 Peter 2 and talks about enduring like Christ did, who when he was reviled, not again, and so forth. And then if you know they're still going to be getting to you, then you have to confront them in humility, understanding that you've been there yourself. If that doesn't work, then you just have to endure it. Yeah. That's what it is. And so the answer to it is love in 1 Corinthians 13:4. It's not irritable. In 1 Peter 4:18, love covers a multitude of sins. So I'm rushing through there. We're going to open our Bibles and get to some of these others, but I just figured, other than Frank, none of us have a problem with irritability or anger. So
that really annoys me.
Hey, get quiet back there in the back of the room now.
Now, if you're a parent and your child is being irritable, you just do what did you say here? You have to endure it,
or do you confront it?
Or do you confront it and then do you do that with like your friends in the Bible study? So.
With compassion, humility, forgiveness, and reverence.
Okay, option
one if I'm successful.
Yeah. John, you'd have to be the one to do that.
That does bring up a good point, because I don't think it's particularly wrong if you can say it in a kind way to say, you seem to be upset today or on edge today. Is there anything I can do to help or something like that to point it out to the person? Because otherwise what typically happens is, you take a ration and you take a ration and you take a ration and all of a sudden, boom, it goes back, I don't know if it's how everybody else feels about that, but I don't think it means that we have to just shut up and let somebody else be a jerk forever without pointing out to them their jerkness.
No. And so I think that's a little bit of what the object of someone else's impatience and irritability, you endure it like Christ, is the first one. The option two is to confront, but you're doing it in a kind way. And,
yeah, right.
Perhaps Galatians 6 is the first one that says that when we do it, understanding that it could be us and so forth, and meekness, meekness and so forth. So it's not confront. It's not confront with your finger in their face. It's confront in a humble way.
Growing up, sometimes you have the best fights with your best friends. You have a good fight, and all of a sudden everything's over, and you're best friends again.
Yeah.
But it's probably not the most healthy way to do it. Mm.
True. As we move on to chapter 15, that's a record for getting through a chapter, but that's why the notes are printed out for you so you can see it. Anger, the result of selfishness, pride, or the desire to be in control. And right away he wants to deal with the issue of righteous anger. And basically we love to say, this was righteous indignation because of, so-and-so committed sin against me and so on. So we try and justify our anger by saying, I was right to be angry. Mm-hmm. I could say I was right to be angry at this custodian because, she was making these snide remarks. It wasn't my stuff, first of all, it was school stuff being carried to the computer lab. If it was my stuff, I would have gone and taken two trips. But a computer lab's in an opposite direction. It was a rainy, drizzly type of a day out, and she's got a cart that she can take those things off on and so forth. So they stayed there, and I did it the next morning myself. But, I could have said, hey, it's not my job, and she could have done it. Not like she's not overly busy. I've been a school custodian. I know what the evening job in particular is like. And she's not one of your best custodians because I've had her for a couple of years now. She doesn't. A lot of stuff slides by, cobwebs and stuff like that. So it's just, I could have said that was righteous indignation, but that's not it. I was already reading this chapter when that came across. This is a good chance for an illustration, so I'm going to go ahead and get taken off. But, it's a little bit of pride or selfishness or the desire to be in control. And you want to be the boss, and you're going to tell them what to do, and they're going to do it because you're in charge. Let's go ahead and open. We've already referred to 1 Peter chapter 2. Let's look at that passage. Since we've mentioned it a couple of times, it's certainly worthwhile. But 1 Peter chapter 2. Passage where he's dealing with, in this case, servants, and then he gives the example of Christ. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to do the good and gentle, but also not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing when, and the key words here are mindful of God. Are we mindful of God? Are we bringing God to mind? Do we have a conscience, basically? The word has to do with conscience, our conscience towards God. Being mindful of God, one endures sorrow while suffering justly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if you do good and suffer for it, you endure. This is a gracious thing in the sight of God. So it's basically, the word is godliness, but it has to do with godliness here. Are we really thinking about God as we react to different situations? What should we be thinking about? We should be thinking about God's glory. What's going to bring Him glory, and what would be God's will be done? And so Bridges asks a series of these questions that are in your notes there. But of course, the problem is when we get ticked off, like I did with the custodian, we don't sit there and evaluate. We just spout off. We just get ticked off and we say certain things. But if we had opportunity, we'd stop and say, well, how should I respond? What should I say? What would God want me to do here? Is God in control of this situation? Over and over again, we've seen, and we're going to continue to see it in today's study, the sovereignty of God. God's in control of these things. And so when we react in certain ways with certain sins, such as anger or impatience or selfishness or some of the others, God's in control. And we need to recognize that, because otherwise we're saying, hey, God's not in control if we react in a certain way. And then the big question, can God use this to form Christ-likeness in me? Because that's what it's all about. That's what in James chapter 1 is talking about, is, you know, not the Christ-likeness isn't there, but basically he's working, build character in us by putting us through the trials. And certainly don't want to pray for them, but they're going to come our way. So, what do we do is when we have that time of reacting, we have to confess it as sin. We have to seek forgiveness. We have to change our attitude towards that person. Ephesians 4:32 is to always be forgiving towards the other person, and they seek their forgiveness, and then just hand the situation over to God and let him be in control as he's supposed to be anyway, instead of us trying to be in control.
Don't you think that even if we don't say it, that we feel it and rage inside, that it's basically the same?
You got Frank to sit up there on that one. You know, and he actually does do that in one of the ones that we're going to look at today. He does that in particular with the, which sin was that? I think it was, not sins of the, yeah, it was sins of the tongue. Sins of the tongue, he actually talks about that in particular, because sometimes we get, and it kind of relates to, he referred to a situation where I think his wife had said something and he got upset with her and then stopped real short. This isn't the way I should be reacting. And stopped and didn't do it. And so the next morning, as he's having his devotional time, he was thinking about that situation and kind of having a little pride how he controlled it. And then he realized, wait a minute, I thought it.
Yeah.
And just thinking it. And we're going to have in our notes, I think it's Psalm 19:14, where it says, let the words of my mouth and the what?
Meditations
of my heart be acceptable in thy sight. So it's not just what we say, but it's also what we think.
So that's going to be the hardest thing to get
that
under
is.
Control.
But we go and confess it. But once we start becoming recognizing that, then we start, you know, it's a process that develops and we get more used to thinking that way.
Sort of
so
heal from that.
Right away we can say, the thoughts are there and I can confess it, and that might stop us if we become used to it. But if we become used to doing it the way we've always done it, or the way everybody else always does it, we're going to spout off our little vindictive comments and move on, because that's what everybody else does. I'm just like everyone else. And that's not what we're supposed to be like. We're supposed to be like Christ. He's the standard, not everyone else.
Is there a time you can be angry?
Is there a time when you can be angry? Yeah. Let's see, what does it say here? Up at the top on that, on the notes, it's anger. Righteous anger is when you're angry because God's law has been violated.
And usually that's not the case.
That's usually, we try to rationalize it that it's the case.
Someone in my band poll says, she yells at us every morning for being late or something like that. And she says, and this is righteous anger, so it's not bad. And I'm going,
well, I think so.
Like the Muslims building the Dome of the Mosque on Temple Square, should we have righteous anger about that? Clear violation of God's law? Something that should not have been done?
Well, are we going to go and destroy it and burn it down? And
what kind of anger could
we have? Jesus cleansed the temple.
Well, you can have that kind of anger, and then you need to pray about it and give it to God, because even righteous anger, if you do not let go of it, will corrupt you.
Yeah.
We know that it's supposed to be short term. Any anger you have is supposed to be before the sun sets. We're supposed to clear it up, you know.
Yeah.
So that would mean it's not righteous.
Well, the sun's still up.
Yeah, really.
Take that guy out of second grade.
I heard one pastor say one day, you know, I don't know if it's true or whether he was being facetious, but he said, no human being is capable of righteous anger.
I don't think so, because we get in the way.
Yeah.
And our pride issues get in the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then what you asked a minute ago is it anger that we need to be careful of, or just the display of that anger?
And that's why I was asking.
I think that other question. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the anger itself. Yeah.
Well,
the
what
angry
about,
and sin not to, you know.
Well,
it says to be angry, but don't sin
angry.
With it.
Aren't there some steps before you get to that red zone? I mean, you've gone. There's.
It turns on real quick.
on the other hand, like what. If it's true, what happened in Baghdad the other day, where if it's true that the bad guys tricked a couple of Down syndrome ladies into strapping on explosives send them into a marketplace and then detonate by remote control. The women themselves may have not known what was on them and what was going to happen. To not be angry about something like that would almost make us less than human.
Yes.
You know, I'm not sure how to
display that anger.
Yeah.
I think we should go before the Lord and say, Lord, that was so terrible.
Well, how can you not be?
I think if we somehow
somehow try to excuse it or deal with it, but not become angry. My gosh, what kind of people are we that couldn't be outraged by that?
Yeah.
But can't we do that before the Lord? You know what I mean?
Well, instead of
venting it to your wife, saying, go to God.
I wonder if in sports or if in a war situation, if soldiers can use anger.
Who?
Soldiers.
I mean, did the armies of Israel get angry at the Philistines? Oh, yeah. And they went out to collect vengeance. I don't know, can our soldiers be angry today when they're in combat? And use that anger to go do things that are contrary to what our spirit is and what we know is.
I think they enjoy it.
There are those, that's true. They usually end up needing to go over to the VA hospital.
It's probably beyond the scope of respectable sins thing, and I would think particularly we're dealing with Christians who are struggling with the subtle sin of anger, and we're looking at, we could come up, I have a man that I know, one of the gentlest, soft-spoken men I've ever known, but when he was doing a short-term missions thing, I think for a year, down in Peru, his wife, they got invaded or attacked by some guerrillas or whatever, I don't know, and one of them started violating his wife. Mm-hmm. And it ticked him off, and he got hold of a 2x4 and beat that guy, and the guy died.
That's
righteous anger.
Well, yes.
What would the Quaker say?
When you have righteous anger...
Is that our standard?
When you have righteous anger, you have to channel it the proper way. One thing, for instance, you see a child who's being abused. The proper thing to do, if you have the ability to stop it at that moment, mm-hmm. then that is what you should do. And if it's going to take your righteous anger to give you the kick in the seat of the pants to get over and take care of it rather than ignoring it, then that's what your anger is being used for.
Right. Right.
But the other thing is, you call Child Protective Services. Mm-hmm. That is the proper thing to do. Like this thing with the women, the mm-hmm. bombing. You write to your government and say, I expect you, when this opportunity mm-hmm. arises, you prosecute and take care of this situation, because mm-hmm. that's what the government's job is for.
Right.
The government is
right.
there to take care of those kinds of things that we can't take care of. But we need to go to the proper authorities or do the proper thing when we have a righteous anger. I don't think that he's talking about that. As far as a respect. But there are situations where there is a righteous anger when you see, particularly with children, when you see children in a situation that they're being harmed or abused or whatever, then we should be righteously angry. And we should do something about it, not just sit back and do nothing.
Yeah, definitely. We just have to, I think it's... Be careful not to let it become our excuse for our anger.
Right. We still need to give that anger over to God.
Yeah.
And when we do the right
thing. And let God be in control, such as with the mosque being built. God's in control, and the temple's going to get built where it's going to get built, and we know that. So we don't need to go in and do something. Maybe the nation that needs to, but us as individuals. No, I wouldn't think so. Chapter 16 continues talking about anger with the area of weeds of anger. Anger leads to greater sins that are dangerous, and he uses the words poisonous and noxious, and I think a couple of other words as well. Let's look at Ephesians 4:31. We won't look at both of those, but Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3 are very kind of parallel what they have to say. But notice what some of these sins are connected with. Ephesians let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice. We just have, you know, these are the weeds of anger. So some of the words that he uses in his book, I've got them listed there for you, and we won't go on to it, but too deeply here. But resentment and bitterness, enmity, hospitality. He talks about a grudge, and the example of Genesis chapter 27 would be Jacob and Esau, and the grudge that Esau had held towards Jacob, and then Genesis 50, of course, is the grudge that Joseph's brothers were afraid Joseph would have against him for doing what he was, they had done to him. Joseph was in a situation where he could have resented that, because how many years did it take before he was in that position being first of all sold into slavery and then ending up in prison through no fault of his own, in fact, through doing the righteous thing and fleeing from Potiphar's wife. And nothing was working out for him, and he could have sat there, and he was in that prison for a couple of years, and things weren't going well, and he had all kinds of, you know, my brothers caused this, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those doggone brothers of mine. And
he does kind of get even with his brothers, though, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, the dreams came true, obviously, and so certainly would have been, humanly... the human response would have been, "I got this."
He never is. He's making a point, but you can see that it's emotionally tearing on him.
Yeah. So, and then we have strife, and all of these things are, resentment, bitterness, enmity, and hostility. They all kind of are within us, but the grudge is even within us towards one person. But they can eventually lead to strife, which in Scripture is usually associated with groups of people being. And some of those things aren't all that subtle, and I put that point in there. They're strife in particular gets pretty ugly oftentimes, especially in churches. And again, these are subtle things that they just kind of sneak up on us. And so some things that he does and nip it in the bud. I like the way Barney Fife says it on Andy Griffith. Nip it! Nip it in the bud! You have to nip it in the bud. And so again, we have the sovereignty of God. And 1 Peter 4:8, that was a good verse. I referred to it before too. But in 1 Peter 4:8, we know the part where it says let love covers a multitude of sin. We're familiar with that part. But the other part says that we are to, above all, talking about being self-controlled, sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. Above all, this was the most important thing for Peter, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. We gotta work at love. This word diligently is the word for stretching. We have to stretch ourselves sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it takes to get over this. And then, of course, he spends a good deal of time, and he does it both in his Practice of Godliness book, and really great the way he explained the parable of the unforgiving servant. And the unforgiving servant, his master, he owed him billions of dollars. When you look at the amount that was there, it was, more than a lifetime worth of income that he actually owed him. And so that's what we owe God. We owe a lifetime worth of debt when it comes to our sin. And that he goes out and he's not willing to forgive half a year's salary, basically. And just little tiny things that happen, we're not willing to forgive. And compared to what we have done to God, whatever someone does to us is practically nothing. Virtually nothing. That might hurt, but it's really nothing. And then... Romans 12:18, as much as possible, I, Flynn, you live peaceably with all men. And we're going to be looking at Romans 14 when we get into judgmentalism here in a couple of minutes. So let's hold off on that passage. He doesn't do it in his book, dealing with the anger and its weeds, being prepared for it, but he does it in, I think, Practice of Godliness, and also in the discussion guide. He has these three points. Proactively, what will we do to prevent it? What are we going to do ahead of time? We're going to have to think ahead of time.
How are we going to deal with things that are not going our way and it's starting to get us angry? And then when it does happen, how are we going to respond? You know, when in the heat of the moment, I would say the heat of the moment is a growing thing. You know, it's like we got to get used to it. We know it's going to come, and so we got to be prepared for it. What are we going to do when, like the situation with this custodian? Well, how are we going to react? And obviously, I react in a poor way. And so, you know, hopefully next time I'll recognize that and grow from that experience and say, okay, I got to be ready for something like that. And I needed to, what I needed to do was walk away with my mouth shut instead of walking away is what I was doing, because I was ticked off already just with her attitude. But I hadn't said anything wrong. But when she said the last thing, it was I'm walking away, says, I don't know why people can't carry their own stuff. That was the straw that broke the camel's back type of a thing. And I spat it off, you know, and I needed to keep walking with my mouth shut. And so hopefully next time I'll remember that, because I recognized it as something that I did wrong, and I, you know, the thoughts were there and I needed to walk away and not do it. Reactively, what will we do when it's already happened? We've already blown it. Go back to those points that we had earlier, you know, confess your sin, ask forgiveness of the other person and so forth, but we need to be ready and be prepared for it. And
so, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, to be prepared.
Yeah.
Especially if you know you're an angry sort to begin with.
Yeah.
To be prepared for that.
Yeah.
Potential crisis.
Yeah. All right, we have four chapters to go. Now we're at the one without any notes to fill in.
I want to share something on the proactive. When you find tools that help you, I think it's a good idea to go ahead and use those tools no matter where they come from. And something that has really helped us in our household is to figure out what people's temperaments are, which is, you know, in the realm of psychology, but it's been around since 600 BC, so I think it's, you know, pretty stable. But figuring out what someone's temperament is actually helps you to figure out how they're going to react to something or how they're going to behave. And when you figure that out and realize that you can't change them, then you can be proactive and you can be ready for it, you know. And that has been so helpful in calming situations down, just knowing this is really how this person's going to react. I'm prepared for it. It's not going to upset me because I'm expecting them. And then when they, if they don't act that way, you can be pleasantly surprised.
Right. That's like my van pole partner. I know she's always going to do that. So I know not to react to how she responds now.
Right.
Here we go again.
But everybody else in the van pole hates her, and I've chosen to love her, and I pray about that.
Mm-hmm. Love the unlovable.
It's true.
And that could be a temperamental thing where perhaps she has the kind of temperament where rules, obeying rules are very important.
Yeah.
And if you understand that, then you say, well, that's a person who's a rule person.
Yeah.
It's very important. And when you run across a person who isn't the rule keeper, then the rule person has to also accept that person, you know, who...
If I'm in that situation and I'm the one that likes rules.
Yeah.
On the other hand, one of these mornings you should just drive right by and keep going.
Safer?
Yeah. Oh. Try that a few times. She might be thankful you stopped later on, even if it's late.
And your last deal, which is kidding, John.
Well, we have four chapters left. Four chapters left. There's a fifth chapter, but it's more of just a conclusion. It's not a new sin. So there's four subtle sins that are left. One is judgmentalism. The next one, chapter 17. Excuse me. Did I skip one? 17. Anger, 16. Nope, I did. 17, 18. That's right, four. Judgmentalism is one. And then we're going to have... envy, jealousy, and things that go along with it. It was interesting the words that he chose to use, but they're kind of connected to envy and jealousy. So, and then sins of the tongue. And finally, we have worldliness, so the last one. And it's interesting the way he approaches, especially the worldliness, I thought. So I'd like to spend maybe more time with judgmentalism and worldliness. I think, for me, more of a an issue anyway, with judgmentalism and worldliness. So let's look at those two, and then we'll just kind of touch on the other two in the time we have, a little over half hour left. Judgmentalism, God expects us to respect the convictions of other believers. The key word here is convictions. Some people will use, because Romans 14 does, uses the word opinions. So you say convictions or opinions of others. So we're not talking about respecting the differences that are biblical difference. When they're violating the Bible, then we don't respect, show respect for that.
How about cultural?
Cultural differences.
I mean, our opinions and our convictions that are based on our culture, as opposed to
the
Bible.
Probably, yeah. And we'll talk.
We're all creatures of the culture that we're in.
Yeah.
So.
And some of that will come across as culture when we get into some of the issues here, the examples that we can have here. But let's look at Romans 14 to get the probably the classic passages of probably 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10, that dealing with meat offered to idols and so forth. But Romans 14 is the passage that he touches on. I wouldn't say he does it very thoroughly, but he does use that as a basis to start. So Romans 14 verse 1 says, "As for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions." The word opinions means your reasoning, your rationale for why you're doing certain things. When someone else comes to a different conclusion, sometimes an opposite conclusion, they've done it with rational thinking. That's the kind of word that has to do with this word for opinions. It's your reasoning behind your actions. And the two examples he gives, one who says you can eat anything, while the other one says, "I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat meat," because it might be meat that's been offered to idols is probably the issue there, but it's not clearly put out that way. But it is in 1 Corinthians. And then the other one, down in verse 5, one person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. The word esteem is really the word judge. There's another word for esteem. I don't know why my translation is using that one, but basically it's they judge and say, "Hey, Sunday is the day that we got to set that aside." And you know, some other says it's Saturday, and others say, "Hey, they're all alike. It doesn't matter. We're not under law. We're under grace." And so, in the case of the vegetarian versus meat, it's like I've looked at all of this stuff and I've decided, "Hey, it's wrong to eat meat, because it might be a sacrifice to idols. Mm-hmm. I don't do it." Another one says, "Hey, I come to the opposite conclusion. It's okay. God has blessed everything. Look what happened to Peter on the rooftop there with the prayer before he went to the house of Cornelius." And so then another person comes along and says about the days. And so they just came to a different conclusion, not necessarily opposite. And what does Paul say? What is his answer? Two responses. Judging because they were unspiritual is one. This person saying, "I'm more spiritual because I keep the Sabbath." Mm-hmm. Or, "I'm more spiritual because I don't eat meat that's been offered to idols. In fact, I make sure I don't, because I eat only vegetables just in case. Look how spiritual I am." Mm-hmm. And you think the other person is unspiritual, or you might even use the word their commitment is, they're kind of shallow when it comes to commitment. I'm committed because I don't do certain things, and we'll talk a minute about some of the things that we get onto to substitute the Sabbath or the meat issues. And the other response is, we judge because they were superior. You are superior. You're judging because you are superior. I'm better than them because, you know, I don't have any hang-ups about meat. I don't have any hang-ups about days of the week. And so, you know, I know I'm free, and so I'm more spiritual. Both sides are trying to say they're more spiritual, basically.
Sure.
I'm more spiritual because I have the freedom to do the meat and the Sabbath. And all the other little issues, the cultural issues really that come into play on it. So what's the answer? Let's look at some verses here in the passage in Romans 14. First of all, verse 4 says, and this is just related to the eating meat or vegetables part, who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be withheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand. Basically, who made you judge? You're not the boss. So, stop trying to play God. Stop trying to be the judge. That's not it. And he kind of says the same thing in verse 13. Therefore, let us not pass judgment on one another any longer. Mm-hmm. Wrapping up the discussion there as far as the meat and the days. But he's got more to say, obviously, because the chapter is only half done. But each individual, we'll look at verse 12 before 13. So then, each of us will give an account of himself to God. We're going to stand before the judge. If there was something wrong with eating that meat, God's going to let us know. I don't have to, you know. So let God be the judge. And then dropping down, because there's more to say about this, and this becomes important on a lot of the things that we're dealing with, especially in the areas of anger and sin, as well as envy and jealousy, that we'll talk about in a few minutes. This is really good in verse 20. Yes, is it verse 20? No, I didn't write the verse down. Well, it's verse 19, I guess. So then, let us pursue what makes for peace and for spiritual or mutual upbuilding. Do not, for the sake of God, destroy the work of God. Everything indeed is clean, but it is wrong for anyone to make another stumble by what he eats.
I like 22 even better. Or at least in my translation. So whatever you believe about these things, keep between yourself and God.
Yeah. Keep your mouth shut.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's just basically, you know, what's important here, and again, it's not on clear-cut violations of Scripture. It's not whether we should commit adultery, have an affair, or whatever, or not. It's not whether we should kill a person or not, or whether we should tell a lie or not. It's whether we should.
That's why I call it a cultural preference.
Yeah. So.
Like what kind of songs we should sing, stuff like that?
Yes.
So he speaks specifically of three areas that we see in your outline. The three areas, the judgmental issues of the day, first of all would be the cultural issues, but he uses the word convictions. So we judge somebody else's convictions, and that specifically applies here to the meat and the day being honored. So what are you thinking, some examples that we have today that we judge people on?
Smoking,
that we
drinking,
shouldn't be.
Dancing.
Same thing. I mean, look at Seventh-day
yep.
Adventists.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Okay, there's still that issue.
I mean, and I have workers at work who are Seventh-day Adventists that look at me like I have two heads. Because I'm sitting there with my pork at lunch. And they won't even come in the room because I microwaved it. You know, and they're with their vegetables going, so we do still feel that.
Sure.
And they honor the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I can't schedule them on Friday nights and Saturdays.
Romans 14 must be, would that be a chapter they tear out or a chapter they really dwell on? I don't know.
They say it doesn't matter. It's totally up to me.
Totally up to you to what?
Eat meat, not eat meat, go to church on Friday, Saturday,
it's
or
totally
Sunday.
It's totally up to them?
Yes.
So
they chose.
Yeah.
But they do judge.
So they need 22.
And is that part of
they've got 22.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's strange.
But that is one thing. They still do judge on them. But not everybody in the world does, just
no.
A small group.
So what do we do, say, within the little circle here of Faith Bible Church?
Until the other day, drinking or not drinking.
Dancing.
Okay.
Green light now.
Yeah, baby.
Smoking, dancing.
I know. How about dancing?
Dancing is one, yeah.
Or Halloween. For our children, or Christmas.
Celebrating particular holidays.
Yeah, pagan holidays that have been morphed into Christian.
Well, let's get real down to home.
Watch out.
What college do you send your kids to?
And who do you root for? Yeah.
Who do you root for?
Yeah, Christian college, non-Christian college.
Stay home and go to JC, or incur debt and go to a Christian college.
Wife works, wife doesn't work.
voting yes or no on 94, 95, 96, and 97.
I'm going to vote yes or no.
Yeah, I'm going to vote one of those.
I voted no already, so... but, you know, gambling is an issue for me. It is. I mean, I vote anything that helps gambling to be more successful, so that's why I voted no on those issues. But there was a letter to the editor in the Press Enterprise the other day with somebody voting no because this is a moral issue, and gambling destroys family like alcohol can destroy family and so forth. And I agree with those are my arguments, but I have a problem saying it was a moral issue because I don't find chapter and verse on gambling. But I would definitely say that, you know, I wish there weren't these casinos. I don't do business with Pachanga, even though they might have a great buffet.
That's another thing,
but
too.
Like, am I going to look down and say, Jerry and Sheila went to Pachanga for lunch the other day and say, oh, you guys shouldn't have done that because you're just helping them stay in business? No, I'm not going to say that. But one time I would have.
Because Jen and I had to...
Now I just have to say that's their choice.
We chose to buy their...
We have the theater
Broadway
tickets
play
to,
tickets.
Oh, yeah, we were going to do that too.
And but it wasn't through Pachanga. It was through a Riverside consortium.
Oh.
And so it didn't say Pachanga. And so...
But we will be going out
but
there.
But we do go there. And
theater.
We do like their buffet. So we chose, you know, we can not...
How do you know you liked it?
We did it.
Oh, yeah. We went to see the fireworks at the Morongo.
And by the way, you all want to be careful about what you say because. you know, those are the issues, you know, and you could go to alcohol, and Chris made a good point on alcohol. It's alcoholism, which is sin, not drunkenness is a sin, and it's not necessarily the actual drinking of the alcohol type of a thing. But for me, I've made my choice. My conviction is none, zero, zippo. And at one point I would criticize and judge the person who does do it, who says he's a Christian, but I've come to the point that that's their choice, and I'm going to have to live with that. Wish they didn't do it type of a thing. But those are the issues. Music in the church was an issue that he brought up quite a bit.
Yeah.
I wish we had some.
I don't hear that one as much, but I know it's still around. I mean,
I hear it almost every Sunday. I hear it almost every Sunday at this.
Well,
church.
No, I how can I say? I hear. I don't hear it from the standpoint of one kind of music is unspiritual and the other kind is spiritual. I obviously hear it in
opinions.
Some music is better than other music
and opinions.
But the unspiritual versus spiritual, I don't. You know, I don't. Here, I mean, you know, Chuck Smith had that problem 40 years ago. You know, it was unspiritual to do the guitar stuff, and those people finally left, and then Calvary Chapel was born. But I don't know. I know that's still true in some groups.
Yeah.
I think that white working one is an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
Some people put a lot of weight on that,
well,
almost as if
work.
The Bible said something about whites can't work.
Well, it says
that
she's supposed to be the keeper of the home.
Yeah, well...
But it doesn't say that's all.
She works hard. And
Lydia, she did other things. She was a seller.
And she did have a household. Because she went home and her household got saved.
Right. Yeah. So, there's different things on that
for us. So don't quit your day job.
I think actually the Proverbs 31 passage argues for women having two or three jobs myself.
She's definitely involved in the real estate.
The second area, and I think we're all, and I think Peter had a class on, you know, what was it? Something about the Pharisee, and you. So it was a good class. I don't know if any of you were in there, but second area of judgmental issues would be doctrine, judging doctrine, and so we look down upon people who aren't. Five pointers, and we mentioned this last week, or people who don't have a pre-trib rapture, or people who sprinkle instead of immerse, or and so forth. And we have, and these are areas not of clear-cut moral law, but of interpretation where people have legitimate reasons and they have backgrounds, they have can't think of what the word is, but, you know, a thought process they're right. coming from.
They've come to some reasoning, they've done some reasoning process that gave them, that leads them into a certain position. Mm-hmm. They can change someday, possibly, but if we run into them in a certain position, and then we think they're really weird.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, that's an important one.
Yeah. It is. And then we have a critical spirit. Having a critical spirit is the third area.
Isn't that a gift?
Huh?
Isn't that a gift?
A gift?
The spiritual gifts, racism.
Some people think so. And
unless
so they,
you've got one.
It's, you know, having roast having roast pastor for lunch.
Roast pastor.
After church, you know, roast or criticizing the church leadership because they don't do this or that or the other thing and they should have done this, that, or criticizing your spouse because they, you know, burned the toast, you know, and they should have known the toaster needed to, you know, needed to be turned down, or, you know, criticize a child because they should have got an A and not a B. You know, just constant criticism that can be destructive to another person. And so those are the issues that he deals with today. I would say convictions and doctrine are more the biblical issues, and this critical spirit can become one, but we sometimes will criticize the other person just, you know, because that's our bent. That's what we always have to say something negative. We don't seem to be able to find to say something positive, which will take us into you know, sins of the tongue here in a few minutes. We're going to run out of time probably, but we'll touch on it. But last thing is, when is judging acceptable? When is it a respectable sin, so to speak? In other words, when is it not a sin at all? When is it acceptable and not respectable? When is it even required?
Dealing with apostasy and false religions.
And then we have to make sure we narrow down what is apostasy and what is not. Calvinism versus Arminianism, is that apostasy? No.
Any religion that says Jesus isn't God.
Yeah. So.
Or it says that Jesus did not come physically.
Jesus what?
Didn't come in the flesh.
Didn't come physically.
Anything that messes with the death of Christ as far as what it was accomplishing.
And then how do you judge? What are we judging?
That's where we have to say, you're wrong, you're committing sin, and so forth. And then we also do it with moral issues, adultery, you know, Ten Commandments type of issues, clear-cut thing. And we're basically dealing with this with people who are either professing or are, you know, believers within the church.
Right. So, or your
we
children.
Do it correctly, though. We judge correctly, like you said.
Yeah, that's when two or three go.
Yes.
Right. So, with our friends from Japan who believe that you had to be baptized in addition to salvation, slowly, just we never said anything, but just love, example, continual pointing out.
They changed
their minds. Mm-hmm. But
I think this hits close to home. You're dealing with your children. When your child has a friend that they want to get the date, you know, and this is the child, I mean, the person they want to date is belongs to a false religion. Right, belongs to a false religion. Yeah. You know, I'm not thinking even Catholicism, which you can still be saved in Catholicism. Mm-hmm. I'm talking Mormonism. Oh, but they believe the same things we do. And then you better know what it is. You know, get Walter Martin's book, and Jehovah's Witness, my son is dating a Jehovah's Witness.
With a purpose in mind.
He wanted to save that girl. He came home and he was doing his Bible study, and, you know, it ended up they were going to go to the prom, and at the last minute she said, I can't go to the prom. My mom is sick.
Oh.
It wasn't... Her mom had been sick all along. It wasn't that. It was, I can't go to the prom. You're trying to convert me, you know, kind of a situation. But, you know, and I told him, I said, you know, you shouldn't be dating her. You just want to have conversations with her. That's one thing. So I think that's...
And that would be my opinion, but is that an issue of clear-cut scripture? They violated something. Would we say that marriage would be a violation? I would certainly interpret that marrying them. Jehovah's Witness, or any unbeliever, for that matter,
any unbeliever
is a violation. Mm-hmm.
of Scripture. But dating, where is that found in the Scripture?
It depends on your definition of what are you trying to do, I guess, with dating. If it's, which we're kind of teaching
people.
People
will rationalize it, well, we're just hanging out.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's the issue, is what's your intention?
Yeah. And, which is exactly why Sam got engaged. Because, I mean, he's engaged to a Christian girl. But that it was his intention. He said, I can't lead her on. I can't just have a relationship. You know, he had done that in the past and realized it was wrong for him to have a relationship with the girl, knowing that it was not going to go anywhere. And he came to that conviction of himself. And so he came to a crossroads. Oh, yeah. You know, I just can't be doing this. So...
You just, you know, my opinion is you just don't know when you start dating that non-Christian. Where is it going to lead? Because the emotions become involved and so forth. And that's what happened to my niece here. I got married a couple of weeks ago to an unbeliever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, went to a Christian college for a year. And her dad's a pastor and grew up going to church and has now married an unbeliever.
We talked about that yesterday in the parenting conference.
Mm-hmm.
Don't marry one and make them your project.
So, but John made a valid point, and so there's kind of a warning here when we do have to do the judging because something has clearly been done wrong to violate Scripture, either a doctrine or a practice. You know, you need to avoid it and do it in a proper way, avoiding the self-righteous, I'm better than you because I don't believe that, or I'm better than you because, you know, I don't do that. We have to show respect to the person and do it in the right way. Because, you know, once again, we're not God. So we need to judge and say it's wrong. And sometimes that results in church discipline. I read some issues. One of the things on our church's website is links or something. What other links or whatever web links. And I went to one of them yesterday. And got caught up in it, spent too much time with it, but it was answering questions. It's a Talbot graduate from 1983, Tony Capoccio or something like that. You ever heard of that name?
Capolo? Or
No.
C-A-T-O-C-C-I-O or something like that. Anyway, a lot of John MacArthur stuff on that stuff, but basically referring to, you know, questions, and one of them was dating a non-Christian. And I think they even referred to John MacArthur in church and what they would do, and they might even pursue, depending on the situation, they might pursue church discipline in that in a matter like that. But they would have the parents involved in what the parents are doing, and so forth and so on. But you know, discipline may need to take place in certain situations when it's done wrong.
There was a very touchy situation in our family, in our extended family, in which a lot of family members are living with their significant others.
Mm-hmm.
And it started out that some of these people were claiming to be Christians. And the Bible's very clear, if you're a Christian, you need to judge if this person is committing adultery or fornication. As a Christian, I mean, I find scripture verse after scripture verse. You have nothing to do with this person. You know, you shun them, you confront them, whatever. But it wasn't within our own immediate family. It was in the extended family. So then there was nothing that we could really do or say. And it was like, okay, now are we going to invite these people to something? Are we going to go to something when they invite us? And so what ended up happening, it's a good thing and a bad thing. Because we had to tell our children, how are we going to, as a family, what are we going to do? And so what we decided to do was say, they are not exhibiting any indication that they were ever saved by their behavior. So at this point, we're going to say that they are not saved. Don't care what they said in the past. They're not saved. If they're not saved, it's not a problem. It's only when they're claiming saved that you've got a problem. So they're not claiming to be saved. And Frank even confronted one person, and that person said, I'm not a Christian. I'm, you know, and completely denounced what he had been brought up with previously. And that was like, oh, good. They're even claiming that they're not a Christian. So
that's we go to that family reunion.
Yeah, exactly.
The Bible says you can associate with
them. You can associate with non-Christians, but it's the
Christians. Yes, so that's true. How we've resolved that. You know, really, with all of our children, have to say, because, and it, as the grandchildren, we're going to have to do the same thing. Why can we associate with this and why not with this? Because this person is claiming to be a Christian,
right,
and this person is claiming not to be a Christian. So.
Okay, let's move in with our last 10 minutes here to three more chapters.
Could we just go to worldliness?
We could. I'm going to just touch on the envy and jealousy and talk about the other two sins.
Honestly, I think you can go to 10 o'clock.
Huh?
Church service is not going to be out until 10. It hasn't been since we started.
Yeah.
So here's what we have for this. I turned to the wrong page. There we go. We have envy, jealousy, and I think they're in your notes, competitiveness, which he talks about being an expression of selfishness. Not so much being wrong to be competitive as in playing a game
just
of tennis
sport,
or handball or being involved in Little League and things like that. That's not the type of, it's the spirit of competitiveness. I've got to win and I've got to come out on top. Type of a thing, rather than and the verses he uses, I'm not sure I would use it, but Colossians 3:23, this would be in relationship to the job, and I'm going to do whatever I can to get to the top, step over people, type of a thing. Mm-hmm. But our job on the job is to work heartily as unto the Lord in Colossians 3:23, and specifically in the context of your employment situation in Colossians 3:23, and so that's good for that one. Just you're supposed to do your best job no matter where you are. And but he also uses 2 Timothy 2:15, which I thought was a little bit better, where it says to be diligent to present yourself unto God, which means, in the English Standard Version that I use, actually does say, do your best to present yourself approved unto God. Always do your best, not do better than the other guy, necessarily. It's just do your best. I tell my kids in school, I'm okay with you getting a C if that's the best you can do. Just give me your best. You're not doing it, but that's what I want. So that's the question you have to ask. Are you giving it your best? It's not did you win,
right, but
did you do your best? So that's the question. It's your motivation. It's not to be better than someone else, but it's you're doing your best to glorify God. So that's where he deals with this envy, jealousy, competitiveness. And then he talks about controlling, to be in control so that you get the advantage so that you get what you want. And basically it's a violation of Ephesians 5:21, being submissive to one another. That's the natural reaction, not of the human being, but the natural reaction of a spirit-filled Christian. You're going to submit. And you're not submitting to one another. You want to be in control. You want to be on top. You want to be the boss. And
who are we submitting to?
Pardon?
Who are we submitting to?
Yeah, to one another. We're supposed, well, submitting to God, obviously, but Ephesians 5:21, we're submitting to one another. We are putting ourselves and the word submitting means arranging yourselves underneath, organizing yourself under, as a concept behind submission. And when you're trying to be in control, you're not being submissive when you're the controller.
So we're submitting to authority in the church and to each other.
In Ephesians 5:21, it's submitting to everybody. I mean, you can make the argument, and you should, and I don't know if Chris will do this because he'll start next week or whatever soon anyway, on Ephesians 5:22 or 23. Is it 22 or 23 submitting? Is 22?
22 is wives submit to your own.
Okay, 22 is wives, which the word submitting is not even in verse 22. It's just picking it up from verse 21. But wives to their husbands as an example, basically, of submissiveness. But verse 21 wasn't husband. It was basically, you can make an argument, it's wives submit yourselves to your husbands and husbands submit yourselves to their wives, basically in relationship of Christian, Christian brotherhood, sisterhood, Christian relationships, the church, and so forth. It does go on to talk about, wives submitting to the husbands. The idea of the verb to be supplied to wives to their husbands is the word submission, but that doesn't mean that husbands shouldn't be submitting to their wives. In the sense of, I'm going to do what's best for you, and it's not me over you, it's me under you, what can I do to serve you and help you, type of a thing. I'll leave that whole thing to Chris here that will start up here in the next week or so, but that's key, I think, in controlling. Kind of skipped over Galatians 5, 21 with envy and James 4 in jealousy, but just to touch on Galatians 5:21, envy is one of those things that happen to people who walk according to the flesh. It's, you know, the opposite of being walking in the Spirit with the fruit of the Spirit as a result. So if you're going to walk according to the flesh, this is what you're going to have. You're going to have envy. And Romans 1:28-29 is dealing again with the people who do not acknowledge God, is the way some of the translations. The ones who do not acknowledge God are people who have envy. When we have envy, we're equating ourselves to the heathen.
Envy is one of the Ten Commandments.
Pardon?
Envy is one of the Ten Commandments.
In the sense of
covetousness. Same thing. To envy is to covet.
It's related, although there is a word for covetousness in the New Testament that's different from the word envy, but it does basically involve I don't have something that somebody else has. Very closely connected to jealousy. But jealousy, the word for jealousy really has a positive and a negative aspect to it. Jealousy has idea of zeal.
Yes.
It's the word zeal or being zealous. Right. But now it's zealousness for something that somebody else has. So it could be in a sense that's even stronger than envy.
Wanting their soul
Zealousness goes back to the competitiveness. Zealous for a position.
Yeah.
That would be your competitiveness for a position. That's the zeal over someone else. Yeah.
To deal with these sins, and I'm going to come back to envy and jealousy in a moment, but you got to focus on God's sovereignty. Down at the bottom there, I want to get these notes in anyway. Focus on God's sovereignty. God is in control, as usual. We've seen it with many sins, that respectable sins that Bridges has dealt with. But He's the one who gives us what we have. That includes our possessions, our job positions, our talents, and so forth. And so for us to be envious or jealous of somebody else who has something we wish we had, you know, that's, you know, we're acting as if God's not involved. Or God's being unfair to give them more talent or more money or something than we have. But going back to Romans 1:28, I was interested in the word, they do not acknowledge God. And people who do not acknowledge God, one of those things that they do is they have envy. The word to acknowledge means to have God or hold on to God. And so we're acting when we have envy as if, you know, we don't even have God.
Yeah.
We're not letting God be in control. We're ignoring Him, basically, and saying, you know, we're leaving God out of the picture to have envy. So focus on God's sovereignty and focus on His love. Mm-hmm. We're all one body. And this is, you know, the envy that we have, especially mm-hmm. when that envy is towards somebody else within, you know, a brother or sister in Christ. We shouldn't be envious or jealous. And, of course, 1 Corinthians 3 says that love does not envy. But Romans 13, I don't have that in your notes, but Romans 13, and we don't have time to look at it all, but it says, the top commandment is to love everyone. We owe no man anything except for what? To love one another, because love fulfills the law. And he goes down through that passage and eventually gets to the sin of envy, which is the result of not having love. Mm-hmm. It's hard to love somebody that you wish you had what they have. Mm-hmm. Hard to love that person. Right? You're kind of resentful towards them. They got something I wish I had. And now, you know, hard to love them. So we got to focus on loving the other person that we might be envious. And then finally, focus on what God is doing with us. How is God using us? Super Bowl Sunday, Tom Brady will be the quarterback until he gets hurt. Other than that, second string or third string quarterback's going to sit on the sideline and watch. Not going to really help too much during the game. He may have helped during practice, but he's not going to help much during the game. But with God, there is no second string or third string players. This is Jerry Bridges talking, not Jim Orr. And I like that idea, though. It doesn't matter whether you're the teacher or you're the chair stacker at the end of the preaching. Mm-hmm. We're all important. And so we got to focus on how is God using me, rather than saying, gosh, I wish I could have the talent that that person has. Everybody's important. Just a comment on jealousy before we go on to sins of the tongue. All of these sins have somewhat to do with rivalry, but he speaks of rivalry specifically, Bridges does, with jealousy. When someone is going to get something that makes you equal, makes them equal to you, they're gonna be just as good as you are at something, or they're even gonna be better, they're gonna surpass you. Maybe there's some jealousy with some of the baseball contracts, you know, if the Santana that got all this money, now the next guy's gonna want to get more money than Santana because Santana got so much money from the Mets, $150 million when it all totals out over 6 or 7 years, and now somebody else is gonna want $160 million for 5 years, and remember when Koufax and Drysdale held out for $100,000 in the 60s. Now the bottom one is 340 or something like that salary. But, it leads to fighting. James chapter 4, verse 2. Let's look at James 4. We're going to look at James anyway when we get to the sins of the tongue. Maybe quickly, but James chapter 4.
Yeah, because today Paul Tripp is speaking, and he ended every session on time yesterday.
Wow.
Well, we certainly... Oh, it is past time, though, huh? We're not getting to world.
But the next one won't start till 10:15.
It doesn't start till 10:15.
That's true.
So, he can let out on time. James 4:2, verse 1, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. So there you, I think the word covet in my translation is the word, I think that would be the word for you are jealous. Mm-hmm. You're jealous. Great example of that would be Saul and David. Saul was so jealous of David because he, people were saying Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands, and that made Saul ticked off, and hence we have the constant pursuit of David for the rest of Saul's life as a result of that. So, all of these sins, basically envy, jealousy, competitiveness, controlling, being in control, they're all, according to Bridges, I like this, the result of thinking only of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So it's selfishness. We talked about selfishness in the previous week. Has to do with selfishness. 19, sins of the tongue.
Huh? Yeah, how do you
did
that?
Did I fill it, not fill that
God
one
expects
in?
Expects us to.
God expects us to be content. It goes to contentment, doesn't it? We had this in a discontentment earlier, but I had to pull that one out because he didn't unify it all together. So I kind of pulled that one out myself. These themes are not necessarily his. Let's do sins of the tongue real quickly, and then we'll touch on the worldliness part. Hopefully none of you are too worldly and struggling with that. Interesting verses that he uses for both tearing others down. I think we, because of time, we won't look at James 3, but you're familiar with that, but the tongue is like a fire and sets a forest aflame and all that stuff. And it's good. He uses Ephesians 4:29. So let's go to Ephesians 4:29. This is a great verse because I used to, especially as a young person, used to use this in this verse in terms of profanity, and it probably does involve profanity, but there's more to it than that. Ephesians 4:29 says, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths." So I would certainly put profanity there, but when you read the rest of the verse, but only such as is good for building up.
So you can't be vulgar either, then.
Pardon?
So vulgarity is out too, then.
Vulgarity.
Profanity, vulgarity, all of that.
Yes.
Obscenity.
So here's your theme. Christians should not tear others down, but they should build others up. That's what Ephesians 4:29, and it comes out of the basis of. Let me see if I have what I have in your outline. I know what I have in my notes. The whole context of Ephesians 4, it comes out of what we should be putting off and what we should be putting on. We got to put off the old man and put on the new man. Verses 22, 23, verses 24. We're expected to do that. Let us do that is what he says in Ephesians 4:22. We got to put off the old man
and put on the new man. And part of that would be, among other things, no corrupt communication coming out of our mouth. So, the outline says when we talk, when we're talking about others. And the other one is when we talk to others. So when we talk about other people, there we have the sins of gossip, slander, lying, and a little bit more of what we talked about with having a critical spirit when we have actually critical speech. Critical spirit is just the attitude towards, but then we get to the speech and we always have to say the negative thing about somebody else. This is when we talk about somebody, not necessarily to them. We like to criticize people when they're not around. Mm-hmm. Kind of a backstabbing thing, I guess. So we gossip about people when we say something that may be true or may not be true, but we're gossiping and saying negative stuff. So the question to always ask is, what I'm going to say going to tear somebody down or going to build somebody up? And that's the big deal. Slander has to do with evil speaking. That's the literal meaning of the word slander in the Greek. It's the word evil, and speak is a compound word. Speaking things that are evil, saying things that are evil about someone else, basically, and according to Bridges, anyway, slander is actually telling a lie about somebody. It's not even true. Gossip, it may be true, it may not be true, but we're still tearing them down. Lying, we would certainly want to say we shall not bear false witness, and so we don't tell obvious lies, but maybe we tell little white lies, because that's the situational ethics they used to call it. And it justifies the means and
omission,
Omission,
or exaggeration.
Not telling the whole truth. Let's hold a little bit of the truth back, and then sometimes there's some exaggeration. I mean, even Jesus used exaggeration to get his point across, and he wasn't telling a lie. But so that type of exaggeration, not a big thing. But
here comes the blog. I can see.
Does this dress make me look fat?
Oh dear.
You know, there are times. I don't know how you deal with that, but there's lots of times when saying the absolute truth would tear somebody down. You know, little situations like that.
But is it ever right to do wrong to do right? Or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, coaching a little league.
I have no response to that.
Well, the response is, don't blame the dress. No, but coaching a little league.
There's brawling to follow.
You know, and some kid that playing second base can't feel the ground ball. I mean, do you tell him he's the worst kid on the team? Which is
if there's a way of saying.
Dr. McGee had a way to address it, because he said people would come up and show them his baby, and you know, he'd look at the baby and go, "That's the biggest baby I've ever seen." He'd say, "Oh my, what a baby!"
I'm not trying to be contrary, Jim, but there are a lot of situations that come up where if you say the absolute truth about something, wow, you know, you'll really be piercing people
Maybe you have to think, maybe it's in your opinion, right? You know, the way you're looking at it, you may feel that way, but that's not necessarily
there are some of those issues where it's... You got to tread lightly because you're walking on eggshells.
I think that principle of building up rather than tearing down would dictate to us when to be silent about the whole truth. You know, I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe my conscience isn't as sensitive to it, but it's like you don't have to say the whole truth. If it's not going to build up.
Right.
You know, and
I think it depends on the situation, as in, you know, does this dress make me look fat? You know, you don't necessarily have to say the whole truth.
When you say fat, what did you mean?
I love being a sinner saved by grace.
Certainly want to get out of that kind of a question. We certainly don't have anyone here asking that question of their husbands, I'm sure.
Sinners.
You're just trying to get them to sin, aren't you, when you say that?
You do what Jesus did. You look fabulous in it. And what did he do? You answer a question with a question.
Yeah,
always answer that kind of a question.
Well, don't you look great?
A question. Do you like that dress?
Do you like it?
Yeah. How do you think you look?
What do you think about optical illusions?
That could get a guy in the garage for a month. She's looking for an answer.
And the answer she's looking for is, you look terrific in that.
What answer are you looking for?
Yeah.
I can keep coming up with questions.
You're going to say, oh, Jerry's going to be, what do you mean?
That's the name
spell
off.
I
told
you. Well,
that's the truth.
Are you going to
Yeah.
Oh.
All right. Well, I like this passage in Matthew chapter 12. We're going to wrap it up, and I'll send you guys some notes on worldliness, but I'll touch on a couple of things. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you're evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. That's the key verse right there. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak, for by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned.
My mother told us that very early in life. She did not allow us to say things like guy, golly, gosh, gee, any euphemisms. And she backed it up with that verse right there. You will be held accountable for every idle word that comes out of your mouth.
That comes out of your mouth. And then Psalm 19:14, let every word of my mouth and every meditations of my heart be acceptable in my sight, O God.
That would be good.
It's a great, great verse for critical speech. Worldliness. 1 John 2:15, you're familiar with, love not the world, neither things are in the world. You love the world, the love of the Father is not in them. And so Bridges' conclusion is, we don't really have a big problem with that as a subtle sin. I mean, we Christians might have a problem with it, but as a subtle sin, not necessarily. He went to 1 Corinthians 7:31, so let me just close with touching on that. I had a little problem because the whole context of 1 Corinthians 7 is being married, not being married, and things like that. And so he says, you know, it'd be better for you not to be married, but don't burn and go ahead and get married if you have to, and things like that. But in the context of that, it says, this is what I mean, brothers, the appointed time has grown very short. It's talking about the second coming, basically, is the best interpretation. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods. And now verse 31, and those who deal with the world, though they had no dealings with it. Another translation says, don't abuse it, I think King James Version says, as you're not abusing it. And so
mine says it's not engrossed.
Yes. Is that New International? It's engrossed. Mm-hmm. The New International Version is a good way. Because it's not the same word for dealing and dealing, as my translation says. It's not the same word. It's actually an intensive form of the word. And so it's basically engrossed with it. Yeah, dealings with the world. Don't get engrossed with the world, basically, is what he's saying there. Because this world is passing away. It says the same thing as 1 John 2:15. Mm-hmm. The world's passing away. Mm-hmm. Don't put your priorities there. So that's the whole concept of thing of worldliness. And so the danger areas here are money. Immorality was one of them. Immorality. Christians, as a subtle sin. He talked about vicarious immorality and talked about worldly entertainment. And so if we enjoy reading trashy stuff and watching trashy stuff, we're engaging in immorality vicariously. And then also talked about dressing modestly for women, the girls in particular. And so they just like the world does.
There would be a big difference there today.
Yeah.
Pardon?
There's a big difference between the way a Christian should dress modestly and the way that the world dresses today. Mm-hmm. Huge. Mm-hmm. It didn't used to be big.
But it is huge.
Yeah.
It was always perceived
to be
big, but
I think
in reality,
it really wasn't. Yeah.
Was that number three, or was that part of number two?
That's part of number two, of the immorality. And then dealing with the immodest.
Are you still recording
now? Yes.
Yeah, we're
through.
Almost, yeah. You can go ahead. You can take it.
You can take it. Take it.
All the incriminating stuff is already said.
And then idolatry was the last one, and basically the idolatry that we normally talk about. What's more important to you than God? Your job,